Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Narayan. My name is Kalakanta Das, and Malati Prabhu, my GBC, has asked me to fill in for various reasons this morning, so I have agreed to do so on the condition that she will give us some learned comments at the end of class. So today is the disappearance day of Shri Pad Ramanujacharya. And before we read our Bhagavatam verse, I'd like to speak for a few minutes about him. He is a very important acharya in our Vaishnava line. He was born almost 1,000 years ago, according to most accounts, in the year 1016, so 997 years ago. And he was a great scholar and student as a young man. The Vaishnava line at that time was under the tutelage of Jamunacharya, who was an elder Vaishnav philosopher and saint. But Ramanuja was studying in the ashram of an impersonalist guru named Yadava Prakash. So he was a young man, he was very humble, he was very dutiful, even though he began to disagree with his teacher more and more as the years went on. One day, for example, he was massaging Yadava Prakash's back, and his teacher began explaining some verse from the Chandogya Upanishad, which describes the Lord Vishnu with the word Kalyasana. So Yadava Prakash said, Kalya means monkey, right? And asana means ass. So Lord Vishnu's eyes are as red as a monkey's ass. So when he heard this, Ramanuja was very distraught, so much so that he began crying hot tears, which fell on his guru's back. So then his guru said, so what is the matter? You don't agree with this? And to which Ramanuja replied, actually this word Kalyasana means one that sits on the water. Kalya water asana, sits. So the Lord's eyes are as red as a lotus flower that sits on the water. So when Yadava Prakash heard this interpretation, he realized that this student of his was actually an enemy and was very dangerous to him. So he actually plotted to have him murdered, but Ramanuja escaped. So the tension grew between them. And at this time, Jamunacharya would sometimes come to see the ashram of Yadava Prakash, but he would only look from a distance. And he would see this very brilliant young student, Ramanuja. And he prayed that this brilliant young man could become the next acharya in the Vaishnava line. But he did not interfere. So eventually, Ramanuja and his teacher came to a division over some verse from the, I believe again from the Chandogya Upanishad, Sarva Kalvam Idam Brahman, that everything is Brahman. So his teacher was explaining that, yes, this means there is no duality, everything is one in spiritual existence. So Ramanuja objected, and he said, if you take this verse in context, referring to some subsequent verse, we see that indeed this is not the case. Then he gave the example of the fish. Fish is born in water, the fish lives in water, and when the fish dies, all the elements of the fish return to the water. And yet, the fish is not the water. The fish has a separate existence, an identity in the water. So in this way, he refuted his so-called guru and then ultimately left his tutelage altogether and studied under another teacher named Kanchipura. So eventually, Ramanuja was advised to go and see the great master, Jamunacharya. And he was going on pilgrimage for that purpose, but by the time he reached him, he had passed away. Jamunacharya was there in a very unusual posture. Three fingers on his right hand were clenched. So Ramanuja asked his disciples, is this ordinary? He would have his hand clenched like this? They said, no, we've never seen this before. So then Ramanuja prayed, And he understood the desire of Jamunacharya. So he said, I promise to teach the people in general to worship Lord Vishnu. One of the fingers released. And then he said, and I will comment upon the hymns and prayers and poems written by the Alvars, these great saints of South India. Another finger released. And finally he said, I will comment on the Vedanta Sutra to refute the commentary, the Charivakya Bhasya by Shankaracharya. And then the whole hand unfolded, and a great look of peace came over the face of Jamunacharya. So this was the mission, this became the mission then of Ramanuja. And he's particularly known in our sampradaya for his commentary on the Vedanta Sutra, the Sri Bhasya, which refutes that commentary by Shankaracharya most effectively. So he introduced the tenet of differentiated monism in our line, that there is oneness between God and the jiva, but it is based on a spiritual oneness, but not an identical oneness. This is a cornerstone in the philosophy of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So many of our teachings from Lord Chaitanya come from Ramanuja, and therefore we worship him on this day of his disappearance. It is said that he lived 100 years, and this is often the case in the great acharyas. His disappearance day is known, but the appearance day is not exactly known. So we remember him on this disappearance day. Shripad Ramanujacharya ki jai. So after class, if anyone would like to also add some pastimes, that would be welcome. So now let us read from the 10th canto, 15th chapter, verse 43 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Pitvam, Pitva Mukunda Mukasara Gamakshi Bringais. Tapam Jahur Virahajam Braja Yoshitogni. Tatsat Kritim Samadigam Yavivesha Goshtam. Savrida hasa vinayam yadapanga moksham. Translation and purport by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. With their bee-like eyes, the women of Vrindavan drank the honey of the beautiful face of Lord Mukunda, and thus they gave up the distress they had felt during the day because of separation from him. The young Vrindavan ladies cast sidelong glances at the Lord, glances filled with bashfulness, laughter, and submission. And Lord Shri Krishna, completely accepting those glances as a proper offering of respect, entered the cowherd village. Please repeat. With their bee-like eyes, court. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada describes this incident as follows. Quote, all the gopis in Vrindavan remained very morose on account of Krishna's absence. All day they were thinking of Krishna in the forest or of him herding cows in the pasture. When they saw Krishna returning, all their anxieties were immediately relieved, and they began to look at his face the way drones hover over the honey of the lotus flower. When Krishna entered the village, the young gopis smiled and laughed. Krishna, while playing the flute, enjoyed the beautiful smiling faces of the gopis. The Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, is the supreme master of romantic skills, and he expertly exchanged loving feelings with the young cowherd girls of Vrindavan. When a chaste young girl is in love, she glances at her beloved with shyness, jubilation, and submission. When the beloved accepts her offering of love by receiving her glance and is thus satisfied with her, the loving young girl's heart becomes filled with happiness. These were exactly the romantic exchanges taking place between beautiful young Krishna and the loving cowherd girls of Vrindavan. Junction of the unfolding of Krishna's pastimes in the 10th canto. We have been reading up to this point a lot about the cowherd boys and their various interactions with Krishna. And gradually now the focus will shift to the gopis, culminating in the Rasalila chapters, subsequent chapters. But in this particular verse, we are reading just at the end of the Dainakasura pastime, which involved all the cowherd boys. So I'd like to review that pastime with you a little bit, then ask you some questions about what is distinct and unique about this particular pastime. You've all been reading this, right? Dainakasura Lila. Okay, so I'm going to read a summary from my poetic summary of the pastimes, which is very handy on days when you're not prepared for class. One day some friends, Sri Dham, Subal, and Stoka Krishna said, "Dear Krishna and dear Balaram, a forest just ahead named Talavan is full of palms with luscious, fragrant fruits. Regrettably, it's also home to quite a nasty brute. The demon Dainakasura resides there as an ass, destroying those who pluck the fruits or take them from the grass. His demon friends, disguised like him, are equally as strong, eat men and frighten birds away and lounge there all day long. No one has even sampled fruits that grow among those trees. Their fragrance has attracted us. Dear Krishna, if you please, destroy this jackass demon like the others you have faced. Then all of us can gather fruits and revel in their taste." When Balaram and Krishna heard these words, they laughed and said, "Let's go at once to Talavan. This ass will soon be dead." The boys marched to the forest. Seeing no one else around, Lord Balaram shook trees until their fruits fell to the ground. The sound of falling fruits made Dainakasura enraged. He screamed and rushed at Balaram and, with his two hind legs, kicked sharply at Rohini's son and struck him on the chest. Still, nothing happened, though the mighty ass had tried his best. The demon brayed and dashed about. Then, turning once again, he shot his hooves at Balaram with force to kill 10 men. The agile lord caught both the hooves and spun the ass around until his braying stopped and he no longer made a sound. The lord then heaved the lifeless ass into a nearby palm. It fell and toppled others, like the crashing of a bomb. On seeing this, the other demons shrieked and bellowed. Then they rushed at Balaram, intent on vengeance for their friend. Lord Krishna and his brother grabbed the hooves of every ass and wheeled them round and round until each one had breathed his last. Discarding each dead donkey, like their leader, in the trees, the brothers finished off the pack of ass devils with ease. Their broken bodies looked like clouds suspended, as they were, in palm trees high above where the brief scuffle had occurred. Their bodies dark like monsoon clouds, their blood of crimson tint, and heaps of golden fruits became the landscape's ornaments. The gods, in awe of Krishna and the swiftly finished fight, sang praises and rained flowers down in heavenly delight. The people came to gather fruits in happiness and peace, while cows grazed in the forest grass, which grew up to their knees. Their day complete, the boys went home to take some food and rest. The gopis, in their absence, had been lonely and depressed. As honey-dripping lotuses appeal to honeybees, when Krishna came back, all the gopis gazed and felt relieved. Lord Krishna then accepted, as respectful and of worth, their shy, submissive glances, lightly sweetened by their mirth. The boys and Krishna all went home, and Yashoda was pleased to render service to her son in loving ecstasies. So this is the feelings of the gopis after being away from Krishna all day. And now, they have not seen all the things that he's done. They've just seen that he's gone. But who are reading, we see everything that has happened with the killing of the ass demon and all the things that were going on before that as well. Sometimes Krishna would kill 2 or 3 demons in a day. So what is unique about this particular exchange between Krishna and Dainakasura that is different than all of the demons that he has killed before? Who are some of the demons that he killed prior to this? Putana? Chinavarta? Shakatasura? Batsatsura? What? Agasura? What? Bakasura, right? Very good. So all of these demons have been killed, and many of them in the presence of the cowherd boys. So what is unique about Dainakasura? Okay, this is one thing, right. Balaram killed him. Krishna delegated Dainakasura to Balaram. So yes, that's one unique facet of this pastime. Previously, Krishna had killed every one of them personally. What? Pardon? Was Pralamba before this? After. Okay. So, yes, he had personally killed them all. This time he said, Balaram, you take care of this. So this is very important for us to understand how Krishna delegates certain living entities to Lord Balaram to take care of. For example, Duryodhana was very fond of Lord Balaram, and Lord Balaram was very fond of Duryodhana. So Duryodhana was such a rascal, but and so much harassed the Pandavas that it was very difficult for Krishna to love him. So he let Balaram love him instead and take care of him and teach him how to fight with the mace and so forth. Similarly, as Lord Nityananda, Jagai and Madai were very difficult to love. And when they injured Lord Nityananda, Krishna was ready to kill them. Lord Chaitanya was ready to decapitate them. But Lord Nityananda said, wait, you've come to save the most fallen. So if you kill them, who will fill that position? So in this way, he intervened. This is the mercy of Lord Balaram or Lord Nityananda. Even if you displease Krishna, if the spiritual master is pleased with you, you're all right. On the other hand, if you displease the spiritual master, even if Krishna is pleased with you, you're doomed. So this is the mercy of Lord Balaram, that he takes care of all the fallen living entities on behalf of Lord Krishna. So yes, for the first time in this pastime, he was dealing with this demon in Vrindavan. What else is unique about this in relation to the other pastimes, the other demons Krishna has killed? Can you think of anything different?
All the demons came to Krishna.
Yes. Right. All the other demons came to Krishna, like Putana, they're trying to assassinate Krishna, Trinavarta, they're trying to assassinate Krishna, specifically attacking him. But in this case, these demons were just kind of hanging out. They were a nuisance, but they weren't an immediate threat like Bakasura or Agasura. So, yes, this is another difference. And in the mafia, they talk about expanding your territory. So now Krishna is sort of expanding his territory, even to those demons who aren't attacking him. So, yes, he's taking the proactive position. Yes, very good. So that's another difference. There's still yet another unique factor about this pastime. Can anyone think of it? Maybe there's more, just three come to mind. What was the incentive for Krishna to kill this Dainakasura? The cowherd boys requested him, yes. So there was no threat, but they were asking. We really would like to taste those fruits in the Talavan forest. They smell so good. But we can't go there because of these demons. So this indicates a maturing of the relationship between the cowherd boys and Krishna. You see, if we have a friend, and then this friend has some great opulence. We do not like to ask this friend for the opulence until we feel very, very comfortable in the relationship. Isn't that true? There was a story of Shyamasundar Prabhu, who was befriending George Harrison, this great, world-famous, and very wealthy musician. So Prabhupada asked Shyamasundar, you ask George to donate $19,000 so I can print the Krishna book. And Shyamasundar was very uncomfortable with this, right, Malati? You remember this? So I'm going to relate it as best I understand you correct. So Shyamasundar was nonetheless very dutiful and went to George's. He had been invited to George's for a dinner party that night. and evening went by, and he couldn't bring himself to ask, and couldn't bring himself to ask. And finally, it was nearly the end of the evening. They were serving dessert. Everyone was sitting around the table. And Shyamanasundara thought, this is the order of my spiritual master. I have to do it. I must do it. So he blurted out, George, Prabhupada wants you to donate $19,000 so he can print the Krishna book. Now, George, being so opulent, had a real issue with people asking him for money. He sometimes felt like nobody really liked him for himself. They just wanted his money, and so many people asked him. So he thought he had a friend in Shyamasundara, but then he was thinking, oh, he's just another person who wants some money. And the room grew icy cold, and nobody said a word. Just then, there was a clap of thunder, bolt of lightning, and all the lights in the room went out. And everyone was still sitting silently in the dark. Then after a few moments, the lights came back on, and George said, well, I guess I'd better give it then. So it takes a great deal of familiarity to ask a wealthy or powerful person to share their opulence with you. You don't want to do it prematurely. So in the case of the cowherd boys, they had seen Krishna killing all of these demons. And sometimes they saw him do things that even their parents didn't know. For example, when he killed Agasura, they didn't find out about it for an entire year. And of course, why is that? Yeah, the boys were all asleep, and the replacement boys didn't tell their parents. So the cowherd men and women didn't even find out about Agasura until a year later when they came upon his dried up body. So during that time, Krishna was manifesting himself as all the cowherd boys. And it is said that the cowherd boys during that year were betrothed to the respective cowherd girls. So they all wanted to marry Krishna. And in this way, they were able to fulfill their desire. And then when all the replacement boys came back, they were more or less like replacement husbands. Because the gopis were already married to Krishna. So this is why in this verse, we read about them exchanging these very intimate kind of loving exchanges that otherwise would go on only between those in a very committed relationship. The gopis were looking at Krishna with very affectionate glances. But they were already betrothed to other boys. See? So nonetheless, they couldn't help themselves looking at Krishna with bashfulness, laughter, and submission. So bashfulness is the element in nature that protects chastity. So this shyness keeps ordinarily, it would keep a chaste woman from glancing at another man. But their glances reflected this shyness, but they could not resist looking at Krishna anyway. And they were also very pleased to see Krishna. So their eyes were sparkling and they were full of laughter and happiness, spontaneously reflected in their glance. And submission. They were looking at Krishna like, please accept me as your servant. Please accept me. And all of these emotions were conveyed in a nonverbal way, just by the quality of their looks. So Krishna could have turned them away. He could have looked straight ahead and pretended not to see. Or he could have raised his eyebrows and said, what are you doing looking at me like that? But instead he gave them a look that said, yes, I accept your expressions, all of them. Thus engladdening the hearts of the gopis. So these are all of the nuances and subtleties of these wonderful loving exchanges between Krishna and his devotees, both the boys and the girls of Vrindavan. So any comments or questions on this much? Malati, would you like to say something? Could we get a microphone for her, please? Pardon me? What? Continue. Well, anyone like to make some comments or questions at this point? Speechless. Everyone is speechless. Yes.
So often in my reading, I'll find that Srila Prabhupada says that these relationships between the gopis and Krishna are not the ordinary emotional affairs that we find in this world. But in this purport, there's an interesting phrasing where he says that it actually describes the emotional, it sounds like he's describing the emotional affairs between boys and girls, and says these are exactly like that. So how to understand?
When a chaste young girl is in love, she glances at her beloved with shyness, jubilation, and submission. Yeah? When the beloved accepts this offering, the loving girl's young heart becomes filled with happiness. These were exactly the romantic exchanges taking place between beautiful young Krishna and the loving cowherd, also Vrindavan. Okay. Just to clarify, this is a purport by Sri Dayananda Maharaj and Gopi Pranadana Prabhu, just to make sure we're clear. But the your point is, on the one hand, we say these loving affairs of Krishna and the gopis are not like those of the ordinary conditioned souls. On the other hand, the commentator is saying they're exactly the same. So the example is given of iron and gold. Both are metal, but there is a different quality. So the similarity is there, but the difference also. And the difference is that the loving relationships between the gopis and Krishna are not based on an expectation of sense gratification, but they are based rather on an entirely different platform of total devotion and desire to please Krishna. In ordinary relationships, there is always a disappointment because the conditioned soul cannot help but approach a conjugal relationship with a spirit of enjoyment. So when it said this manifests in a marriage, for example, the girl is thinking, I can change this man. And the man is thinking, this girl will never change. And both of them are wrong. Both of them are disappointed. So the loving affairs of Radha and Krishna, or the gopis and Krishna, are an entirely different affair because there's not a hint or a trace of sense gratification, of personal desire, of self-centeredness in the relationship. Utter expression of love for Krishna in the highest possible capacity. So for this reason, we are enjoined not to go immediately into these pastimes because they cannot be understood. When one of my godbrothers was on a radio show in Los Angeles many years ago, a caller complained, why do you worship a god who has so many, who dances with so many other men's wives? How can you worship such an immoral person as God? And he responded, according to our understanding, everybody is God's son and daughter. Therefore, all women are his wives. So the real question is, why are you dancing with Krishna's wife? This way he very expertly defeated him. There was also a court case in Europe. Have you heard this story? So the Catholic Church was cracking down on the devotees, saying they're a cult, and they're worshiping this immoral god along the same line. How can he dance with so many women and be considered God? So in the defense, the devotee's lawyer called a nun, one of the protagonists in the case, who was pressing the charges. And he asked her, so you've taken vows as a nun? She said, yes, of course. And what are your vows in relation to Christ? And she didn't want to answer. And he pressed and pressed. And finally she said, I have vowed to become the wife of Christ. So ordinary people look at this and become envious, look at these pastimes and become envious of Krishna, because they want to be in the conscious, and they want to be the enjoyer. But only Krishna can be the enjoyer. Ekala Ishwara Krishna Arasabhyabrit. Well, there's only one supreme controller, and all others are dancing according to his direction. It's such a nice philosophy, very simple to understand, and it brings out all the good qualities in the human being. Yas yasti bhaktir bhagavati kinchana. If we just try to please Krishna at the cost of everything else, sarvayagunas tatra samasate sura. All the qualities of the gods, the good qualities become manifest. Harav abhaktasya kato mahadguna. For the non-devotee, where are the good qualities? Mano retainasato davato bahi. Inevitably, they will become captured by the desire for sense gratification on the mental platform. Mano ratta, and ride the chariot of the mind. So this is a very difficult question to understand, that how we can appreciate the non-devotee and at the same time not become infected by their association. It's enjoined, Trinadapi Sunechena Toroi Vasahishnana. We must respect all living entities, even those who cannot understand Krishna properly, and give them respect and want no respect from them. This will enable us to practice our bhakti without inhibition. So it's a very important question that you raise. We have to appreciate the good qualities we can find in others, even if they're very difficult to find. His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj, he is a great mentor for me in this regard. One of your disciples, Maharaj, told me he can glorify an amoeba. So this is the quality of the Vaishnava. Even if they are unable to enter into Krishna consciousness, to find out what are their good qualities and appreciate them. Yes, Mataji. Ibo. It's on. Yeah.
Thank you very much for your class. Could you please speak about the anartha that Dhenukasura represents, and how can we remove that anartha from our own lives?
This is given by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, correct? Which is the anartha? I don't recall. Does anyone recall, Malati? Sorry, what is that? Okay, gross material intelligence and ignorance of spiritual knowledge. That is represented by Dhenukasura. This is like the mudha ass, right? Avajananti ma mudha, manusyam. So they cannot understand Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, they challenge. See, like Dhenukasura and his cohorts had no qualms at all about attacking Krishna. So the gross materialist also has no qualms about denigrating God, insulting God, minimizing or even trying to eliminate the need for God. And there was a debate. Gayananda Bharati, a professor, was debating. Another disciple of Srila Prabhupada. Yes. Another person, I'm confusing these two. This atheist scientist was debating one of Prabhupada's disciples, and he was claiming that science has produced these elements that even God could not create. And he named a few of them that had been produced by nuclear fission and existed only for a few seconds in a laboratory. And so God could not create them because he did not have the technology. So the devotee responded that, why something so complicated? Why can't you just create, if you can make a very complicated element, why don't you make a very simple element? And then he said, for example, why don't you just make an egg? That you know all the elements in the egg. Just make an egg. You know what creates the shell. Wrap it up in that. And then sit and hatch it. And make a chicken out. Why don't you do that? Why is something so complicated? He said, and if you can't do that, then a chicken is a better scientist than you. So the gross materialist thinks like that. I don't need God. And we are all infected by that to a certain extent. You know, when we depend upon our own resources and we are unable to turn our lives over to Krishna, then we're suffering from this infection of gross materialism. We're thinking, okay, Krishna is going to, I'll worship Krishna. I'll worship Krishna and I'll agree with everything he says, but I want to make sure and take care of myself. See, we have this dependence. We have expectations from the material energy, right? For example, we expect that we're going to be able to live 60, 70, 80 years. That's our expectation. And if that is interrupted, we're insulted. We expect that we're going to be healthy during this time. If that is interrupted, we are insulted. We are offended. Wait a minute. What's going on here? That's when this gross materialism comes out. God, what's going on? Krishna, I've been chanting. I've been doing everything you said. And this is how you thank me? This is the gross materialist in us speaking, the mudha. So we need to learn to have expectations. We have very high expectations from the material world and very low expectations from God. We need to reverse that. In other words, we have great expectations. This is surrender. Krishna will protect me. Krishna will maintain me. And as far as the material energy is concerned, any damn thing could happen. I have no expectations at all. I only expect Krishna will maintain me in his own way. Krishna will protect me in his own way. Mama janmani janmani ishwari bhavatad bhakti rahaitikita. Even if it means staying birth after birth, I accept that. So this is how we counteract the gross materialist that is a little part of us all. Is that all right? Thank you. Anything else? Comments? Malati, what would you like to?
Just to add a little PS onto that too. By the mercy of the spiritual master, these gross material propensities are destroyed.
In other words, it's not something that we can do by our own endeavor. That's a very important point. If we just focus on pleasing Krishna, then all the good qualities are manifest. That's the point. We can't independently create them. In fact, these qualities are known as road signs on the path to devotion. They are just like if you're driving on the highway, you see a sign so many miles to your destination. You don't equate this road sign with the destination. So in the same way, the qualities of the Vaishnava manifest. They are not the destination. They're just an indication that you're on the right track. See? So we don't aspire for them separately. But by the mercy of the spiritual master, mukham karoti vachalam, a dumb man can speak eloquently. Pangum laghayate girim, a layman can cross mountains. Yet kripa tamahan mande, shigurun dinatai. Thank you. Anything else? Yes, Nityadita Prabhu.
I was thinking of when Prabhu brought up the point in the purport, how it's described to be exactly like an ordinary activity, but it's transcendental. So Prabhupada, in the first canto, he talks about himself, how he's going to buy paper and print and get the Bhagavatam printed, and he kind of brings that up as almost like a question, like I'm doing the same thing. There's people going alongside me in Delhi doing the same thing. So how is this, transcendental? It's exact same activity, but because the purpose was the glorification of Sri Hari, Srimad Bhagavatam, therefore that's the transcendental feature of the engagement. Otherwise, so many activities of a devotee's doing looks exactly like, building a temple, so much construction and so many things you have to deal with. you know, so, but if it's doing, if the purpose is for the pleasure of Krishna,
yes.
So similarly with the gopis, they're manifesting all these loving glances and moods and everything. But Krishna's in the center, so it's completely
right. Different. Very good. Very good point. In other words, not just in the conjugal rasa, but in many arenas. Vaishnavara, Kriya, Mudra, the activities of the Vaishnava cannot be understood by the ordinary person. So here in this temple, for example, the devotees have organized a hospital. And they do wonderful food distribution. So sometimes foolish people criticize and say, well, these are just ordinary welfare activities. But they're being done for Krishna. You can do anything for Krishna except be a butcher, according to Bhagavatam. So what are we supposed to do? We have doctors joining. They should cut vegetables, you know. They do what they do for Krishna. That's wonderful. So yes, this is the point. Foolish people cannot understand the transcendental quality of the activities of the Vaishnavas. All right, thank you. Anything else? Then we will, oh yes, one more? Okay.
I was wondering if you could speak on why Balaram was deputed to kill certain demons like Palambasur, Dvida, Dainukasur.
Dvida.
What's significance of him killing these particular demons as opposed to Krishna?
I don't know. Krishna was involved with Dainukasura and also with Pralamba, but Dvidvida was all Balaram. So why does he, you know, why does he do these things? I can't answer. Maybe anyone else? Anyone else can comment on that? Why particular demons go to Balaram and some to Krishna handles personally? There is no difference between Krishna and Balaram. That's one thing. And that they are distinct personalities, like Krishna and Balaram in Vrindavan. Prabhupada asked, who is stronger, Krishna or Balaram? Then he explained that the entire creation comes from Lord Balaram, Shankarshan, and it is all resting on him. And then Balaram is resting on Krishna. So they have that relationship. But they're equally sweet. There's a verse, Rama Nama Ladu, Krishna Nama Ghi, Hari Nama Kanda Shira, Gori Gori Bhi. So Ram's name is like a Ladu, Krishna's name is like Ghi, and the Hari Nama is like sweet rice. So mix them, mix them, mix them, and drink. All right. Thank you very much. So wonderful to be here in this wonderful community and project. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Shri Radha Gopinath ki jai.